Mr. Rhodes turned one of the samples in his big mottled hands before passing it to the American engineer. "What do you make of these, Harry?"
"Well, it'll go 50 ounces to a ton," Harry whistled softly. "Perhaps too rich, like Nome and Klondike."
The American looked up at Ralph.
"How thick is the reef? How broad is the strike?"
Ralph shook his head.
"I don't know. The workings are too narrow to get into the face. This is quartz, of course, not the Banquet reef like we have on the Witwatersrand,"
Harry Mellow murmured. The Banquet reef was named after the sweetmeat of toffee and nuts and almonds and cloves which the conglomerate reef so much resembled. It was made up of the thick sedimentary beds of ancient buried lakes, not as rich in gold as this chip of quartz, but many feet thick and extending as wide as the broad lakes had once stretched, a mother lode which could be mined for 100 years without exhausting its reserves.
"It's too rich," Harry Mellow repeated, fondling the sample of quartz. "I can't believe that it'll be more than a stringer a few inches thick."
"But if it isn't?"
Rhodes demanded harshly. The American smiled quietly.
"Then you will not only control nearly all the diamonds in the world, Mr. Rhodes, but most of the gold as well."
His words were a sharp reminder to Ralph that the British South Africa Company owned 50% royalty in every ounce of gold mined in Matabele land, and Ralph felt his resentment return in full force. Rhodes and his ubiquitous BSA company were like a vast octopus that smothered the efforts and the fortunes of all lesser men.
"Will you allow Harry to ride with me for a few days, Mr. Rhodes, so that he can examine the strike?"
Ralph's irritation sharpened the tone of his request, so that Rhodes's big shaggy head lifted quickly, and his pale blue eyes seemed to search out his soul for a moment before he nodded, and then with a mercurial change of direction abandoned the subject of gold and shot his next question at Zuga.
"The Matabele and Dunas, how are they behaving themselves?"
This time Zuga hesitated.
"They have grievances, Mr. Rhodes."
"Yes?"
The swollen features coagulated into a scowl.
"The cattle, naturally enough, are the main source of trouble,"
Zuga said quietly, and Rhodes cut him off briskly.
"We captured less than 125,000 head of cattle, and we returned 40,000 of those to the tribe."
Zuga did not remind him that the return was made only after the strongest representation by Robin St. John, Zuga's own sister. Robin was the missionary doctor at Kami Mission Station, and she had once been Lobengula's closest friend and advisor.
40,000 head of cattle, Ballantyne, a most generous gesture by the company,"
Rhodes repeated portentously. And again he did not add that he had made this return in order to avert the famine which Robin St. John had warned him would decimate the defeated Matabele nation, and which would have surely brought the intervention of the imperial government in Whitehall and possibly the revocation of the royal charter under which Rhodes's company ruled both Mashonaland and Matabele land. Not such an outstanding act of charity after all, Ralph thought wryly.
"After giving back those cattle to the Indunas, we were left with less than 85,000 head. The company barely recouped the cost of the war. Still, the Indunas claim they were given back only inferior beasts, the old and barren cows and scrub bulls.
Damn it, Ballantyne! The volunteers earned the right to first pick from the herds. Quite naturally, they chose the prime stock."
He shot out his right fist, with the forefinger aimed like a pistol at Zuga's heart.
"They do say that our own herds, chosen from the captured cattle, are the finest in Matabele land."
"The Indunas don't understand that," Zuga answered.
"Well, then the least they should understand is that they are a conquered nation. Their welfare depends on the goodwill of the victors. They extended no such consideration to the tribes that they conquered when they lorded it across the continent. Mzilikazi slew 1 million defenceless souls when he devastated the land south of the Limpopo. And Lobengula, his son, called the lesser tribes his dogs, to kill or cast into slavery as the whim took him. They must not whine now at the bitter taste of defeat."
Even gentle Jordan at the end of the table nodded at this. To protect the Mashona tribes from Lobengula's depredations was one of the reasons why we marched on Gubulawayo, he murmured.
I said that they had grievances, Zuga pointed out. I did not say that they were justified.
And then what else do they have to complain of? Rhodes demanded.
The company police. The young Matabele bucks whom General St. John has recruited and armed are strutting through the kraals, usurping the power of the Ndunas, taking their pick of the young girls.
Again Rhodes interrupted.
Better that than a resurrection of the fighting impis under the Ndunas? Can you imagine 20,000 warriors in Impi under Babiyan and Gandung and Budzo? No, St. John was right to break the power of the Ndunas. As native commissioner, it is his duty to guard against resurgence of the Matabele fighting tradition.
Especially in view of the events that are in train south of where we now sit, Dr. Leander Starr Jamieson spoke for the first time since he had greeted Ralph, and Rhodes turned to him swiftly.
I wonder if this is the time to speak of that, Dr. Jim.
Why not? Every man here is trustworthy and discreet. We are all committed to the same bright vision of empire. And the Lord knows we are in no danger of being overheard, not in this wilderness. What better time than now to explain why the company police must be made even stronger, must be better armed and trained to the highest degree of readiness, Jamieson demanded. Instinctively, Rhodes glanced at Ralph Ballantyne, and Ralph raised one eyebrow, a cynical and mildly challenging gesture that seemed to decide Rhodes.
No, Dr. Jim, he spoke decisively. There'll be another time for that.
And when Jamieson shrugged and capitulated, Rhodes turned to Jordan.
The sun is setting,
he said, and Jordan rose obediently to charge the glasses. The sundowner whiskey was already a traditional ending to the day in this land north of the Limpopo. The brilliant white gems of the Southern Cross hung over Ralph's camp, dimming the lesser stars, and sprinkling the bald domes of the granite kopjes with a pearly light as Ralph picked his way towards his tent. He had inherited his father's head for liquor, so that his step was even and steady. It was ideas, not whiskey, which had inebriated him. He stooped through the fly of the darkened tent and sat down on the edge of the cot. He touched Kathy's cheek.
I'm awake, she said softly. What time is it?
It's after midnight.
What kept you so long? She whispered,
for Jonathan slept just beyond the canvas screen.
The dreams and boasts of men drunk with power and success.
He grinned in the dark and dragged off his boots.
And by God, I did my fair share of dreaming and boasting.
He stood to strip off his breeches.
What do you think of Harry Mellow?
He asked, with an abrupt change of pace.
The American?
Oh, he's very... Kathy hesitated. I mean, he seems to be manly and rather nice.
Attractive? Ralph demanded. Irresistible to a young woman?
Oh, you know I don't think like that, Kathy protested primly.
The hell you don't,
Ralph chuckled. And as he kissed her, he covered one of her round breasts with his cupped hand. Through the thin cotton nightdress, it felt taut as a ripening melon. She struggled genteelly to free her lips from his and to prise his fingers loose, but he held her fast, and after a few seconds, she struggled no more, and instead, she slipped her arms around the back of his neck.
You smell of sweat and cigars and whiskey.
I'm sorry.
Don't be. It's lovely, she purred.
Let me take off my shirt.
No, I'll do it for you.
Much later, Ralph lay upon his back with Kathy snuggled down against his bare chest.
How would you like to have your sisters come down from Kami? He asked suddenly. They enjoy camp life, but even more they like to escape from your mother.
It was I who wanted to invite the twins, she reminded him sleepily.
You were the one who said they were too unsettling. Actually, I said they were too rowdy and boisterous, he corrected her.
And she raised her head and looked at him in the faint moonlight that filtered through the canvas.
A change of heart? She thought about it for a moment, aware that her husband always had good reason for even his most unreasonable suggestions.
The American, she exclaimed, with such force that behind the canvas screen Jonathan stirred and whimpered.
Instantly, Kathy dropped her voice to a fierce whisper.
Not even you would use my own sisters. You wouldn't, would you?
He pulled her head down onto his chest again.
They are big girls now. How old are they?
18. She wrinkled her nose as his damp, curly chest hairs tickled it.
But Ralph, old maids already. My own sisters, you wouldn't use them. Oh, they never get to meet decent young men at Carmi. Your mother frightens them all off. You are awful, Ralph Ballantyne.
Would you like a demonstration of just how awful I can be? She considered that for a moment and then,
yes, please. She giggled softly. One day I'll be riding with you, Jonathan said. Won't I, Papa?
One day soon, Ralph agreed, and ruffled the child's dark, curling head. Now I want you to take care of your mother while I'm away, John. Jonathan nodded, his face pale and set, the tears grimly restrained.
Promise?
Ralph squeezed the small, warm body that he held on his lap, and then he stooped from the saddle and stood the child beside Kathy, and Jonathan took her hand protectively, though he did not reach to her hip.
I promise, Papa,
he said, and gulped, staring up at his father on the tall horse. Ralph touched Kathy's cheek lightly with his fingertips.
I love you, she said softly. My beautiful Katie.
And it was true. The first yellow rays of the sunlight in her hair turned it into a bright halo, and she was serene as a Madonna in the deep fastness of their love. Ralph spurred away, and Harry Mellow swung his horse in beside him. It was a fine red thoroughbred from Mr. Rhodes's private stable, and he rode like a plainsman. At the edge of the forest, both men turned to look back. The woman and child still stood at the gate of the stockade.
You're a lucky man, Harry said softly.
Without a good woman, there is no today, and without a son, there is no tomorrow, Ralph agreed.
The vultures were still hunched in the treetops, although the bones of the lions had been picked clean and scattered across the stony ground of the ridge. They had to digest the contents of their bloated bellies before they could soar away, and their dark, misshapen bodies against the clear winter sky guided Ralph and Harry the last few miles to the ridge of the Harkness Claims.
It looks promising. Harry gave his guarded judgment that first night as they squatted beside the campfire. The country rock is in contact with the reef. You could have a reef that continues to real depth, and we have traced the strike for over 2 miles. Tomorrow I will mark out the spots where you must sink your prospect holes.
There are mineralized ore bodies right across this country, Ralph told him. The continuation of the great gold crescent of the Witwatersrand and Pilgrim's Rest and Tati Goldfields curves right across here, Ralph broke off. But you have the special gift. I have heard them say you can smell gold at 50 miles.
Harry dismissed the suggestion with a deprecating wave of his coffee mug, but Ralph went on.
And I have the wagons and capital to grubstake a prospecting venture and to develop the finds that are made. I like you, Harry. I think we'd work well together. The Harkness mine first, and after that, well, who knows, the whole bloody country, perhaps.
Harry started to speak, but Ralph put a hand on his forearm to stop him.
This continent is a treasure chest. The Kimberley diamond fields and the Witwatersrand banket side by side, all the diamond and gold in the one bucket, who would ever have believed it?
Ralph, Harry shook his head. I have already thrown in my lot with Mr. Rhodes.
Ralph sighed and stared into the flames of the fire for a full minute. Then he relit the stump of his dead cheroot and began to argue and cajole in his plausible and convincing way. An hour later, as he rolled into his blanket, he repeated his offer.
Under Rhodes, you will never be your own man. You will always be a servant.
You work for Mr. Rhodes, Ralph.
I contract to him, Harry,
But the profit or loss is mine. I still own my soul.
And I don't, Harry chuckled. Come in with me, Harry. Find out what it feels like to bet your own cards, to calculate your own risks, to give the orders instead of taking them. Life is all a game, Harry. And there's only one way to play it, flat out.
I'm Rhodes's man.
Oh, when the time comes, then we'll talk again, Ralph said, and pulled the blanket over his head. Within minutes, his breathing was slow and regular.